Hello, everybody, and welcome to TYH. My name is Anglo, and with me, I have my normal co-host, Nike.
Hello.
Null.
Hello.
Glad you're back. And then we have our special guest, Mike from Imperium Press. How you doing?
I'm good, man. How about yourself?
Doing pretty good. Nice day, nice weather. So, yeah.
Yeah, same here. It's no bushfires, so that's a good day here in Australia.
From this time a year ago.
Yeah, we have two people in Australia right now on this podcast.
Neither of them burned to death.
Are we taking over?
Yeah, there is a slow taking over by Australian people. Although Mike's not Australian. Well, maybe he is.
Anyway, secretly.
Yeah, secret Australian. But I met Mike, I don't know if he remembers, but through EBL on one of the episodes that I was on. EBL is this podcast ran by Tyler Hamilton, where they do stuff on different philosophical works. And I think we were on an episode together. It might have been the Kant episode. That's how I first figured out about you. And after talking to you on that podcast a little bit, I think I had to leave early on that podcast. It was like a shambles thing situation. I researched your publishing house, and it's very interesting. Can you tell us about Imperium Press, the history, and what the goal is of this company?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I actually forgot that I was on that podcast.
Yeah, it's funny because I met the EBL guys when it was still kind of a reading group. You know, I think the same thing with you. It wasn't really like an established podcast yet. And so I would go on episodes where I didn't think people were going to listen to them. It's just like, this is our reading group. We're just going to talk about something. So I would like go on episodes where I knew nothing about the topic and I would just make things up.
Nice. Yeah, no, it's come a long way since then.
Yeah. Yeah, it really has. But,
but yeah, as for Imperium Press, so this is a publishing company that I started in, I guess, early 2018 is like the official sort of birth date of it, sometime in February. But we didn't actually release anything for about a year and a half because everything was, you know, there's a lot of prep work that goes into this stuff. Publishing is, it's a lot harder work than it seems. Like everything that sort of comes out on the front end is like, you just don't see it, all the stuff that goes into it. But the first book that came out was Iliad. And then shortly after that, another book called Nemesis. Those came out in September 2019. And as far as the story of how it came to be, it kind of had like a long gestation period. Basically, it started off with, and I only realized this when I was talking to Greg Johnson, I sort of remembered, it started off with this book of folk tales that I had started compiling for my kids. And, you know, that just sort of put publishing on the map for me as far as like, you know, thinking about doing it at all, the logistics of actually putting together a book. And, you know, putting together these folk tales, I just sort of started researching a little bit more and more and more. And I found this actually really interesting study that says that some of these folk tales are super ancient, like go back to the Bronze Age. Hmm. I've been sort of participating in like forums and alt-right related things for quite a long time. Never sort of like jumped onto like anything really public, but I've spent a very, very long time on Reddit actually just ripping the shit out of communists because that's fun to do. And a lot of them are really brain dead. So
do you remember Our European? I think that was one of the subreddits.
Yeah. I do remember that one. Yeah.
I posted like once or twice, but I would check it, you know, during class, but that was a long time ago. Okay, cool.
I was always really strong on, I love the debate subreddits because like, and I kind of just realized this recently that like, I love debate so much because it's sort of this transposition or sublimation of like the fact that I just love to fight in high school. And that's sort of my extension of it without going to jail. So I just, Anyway, I spent a lot of time on the debate subreddits. which is like, you know, on Reddit, that's like throwing yourself into the wolf's den, you know, because there's nobody else there. That's, I mean, there, do you remember Dark Enlightenment, r/Dark Enlightenment?
I think I heard of it, but I didn't really go on it.
Yeah, that was a great forum for sure, man. I learned a lot on that. So anyway, I've been around for quite a while as far as, you know, sort of tangential to all what was called the alt-right at that point, and participated a bit, but hadn't like sort of stepped into any kind of public role or anything at all. And with this, like putting together the Book of Folk Tales and just continuing to read and learn and everything like that, you know, at some stage I just picked up some of the Oxbridge University Press editions of, you know, classic authors for like our side of things. One of them was Giambattista Vico's New Science. And it was really weird because I read the introduction to this one, and they had purposefully published the first, his first edition. It's called The First New Science, if you look for it. And it's in the introduction, the editor basically says, like, look, this is, this book went through three editions, and each one got more and more and more reactionary. But you kind of, like, you know, he's such an important author for the development of, like, many, many other things. So you can't really ignore him, but we're just going to basically, like, we're going to put out the first one because that's, like, the least problematic one. So here it is. And I was just like, what the fuck? Like, you know, I don't know. Like, the whole thing about publishing these old authors, like, like, obviously, like, everybody knows that the universities are totally paused. And the publishing houses that grow out of them, they kind of try to sanitize things that are problematic in ways that are quite subtle. And this is like an example of that. Mm-hmm. So, reading this book, as well as like quite a few other texts, not just from, you know, Oxford and Cambridge University Press, but others as well, you just kind of get the idea that these books are, you're not, I mean, the texts speak for themselves, but like, if you remember what it was like reading Aristotle for the first time or something like that, it's like, you don't get half of it. I remember when I started reading that stuff, I was like, I would mostly like read and reread and reread the introductions and then like delve into the text.
Trying to read the categories. I was like,
So this kind of stuff like really frames where you're coming from and how you approach a text. I think for a lot of our guys, they're kind of beyond that point, but a lot of people are not. So there's really a good, I just saw a good niche for getting in there and kind of, you know, framing these texts according to like, you know, how they should be read, which is faithful to the ideas inside of them and not trying to kind of like just lead you into these blind alleys and like gay byways of liberalism. So
What does that difference look like in terms of the actual, you know, content featured in the book?
So one example here, I'll just use the Iliad, which is the first book we put out. If you read the introduction to the Penguin Classics version, which is this beautiful version, it's really well done. And like the translation is good. And like the introduction is quite long. It's about like 30 or 40 pages or something like that. It's by a scholar by the name of Bernard Knox. And it's a pretty like learned introduction. It's like, he knows his stuff and everything like that. And he's framing it for a general audience. And at some stage he comes in and, you know, he basically does the kind of typical shtick that liberals do, which is to say, you know, this is a book that speaks to all people and like all times and all these things that universal human values and stuff like that, whatever. I mean, you know, if you're reading it for the first time, and this was the first one I read, that stuff just kind of like, you know, you don't really notice it. It just kind of slides into the background and kind of colors your interpretation of the text. For sure. Now, here's our version. Our version is written by Ricardo Duchesne, who I don't know if you guys know him, but he wrote a book called The Uniqueness of Western Culture. And what he did was he basically... I contacted him, and miraculously, before we published anything, he agreed to write the introduction for us. And what he says in ours is that this is a book that can only be understood in the context of the Indo-European warrior aristocracy culture. And to take it outside of that is to do it a disservice and to not understand it. So if you're going to actually like grasp anything that's going on in this book, you need to approach it from within the tradition, from within Western culture. And he sort of plays the Iliad against, say, Gilgamesh, which is another epic. He actually doesn't believe that Gilgamesh is an epic, and he makes the argument in our introduction for that. So basically what he's saying is that the Iliad is this book that's kind of for us. It's a Western thing. It's a, you know, European thing. I mean, that's not to say that other people can't read it or anything like that, but like it has to be understood from within the context of our culture. It says something about us to us. So it can't really be understood from without in a robust way. It would be kind of like, I don't know, trying to read Shakespeare, but like not knowing English or something, like, you know, if you were reading a translation in Hindi or something. So that's just one example of kind of reframing a text that, and of course, an important text, according to, you know, our side of things.
Yeah. Well, speaking of like weird modern editions, I got this edition of Carlyle's Hero and Hero Worship. I don't know. It might have been Oxford or something. But it literally had like five essays at the back and like a long introduction. I could just tell that like this is not worth reading. You know, this is not. You're trying to frame it again in this like weird, like, oh, look at he's reactionary, you know, or so you got to watch out when you read this.
You get to the point where the introduction's longer than the actual book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Just, I can frame it in the particular light they want.
Yeah, so it could fit into like Reddit tier ideas.
Which is too bad for Carlyle, because that guy's so based, man. He's like one of the most based.
For sure.
And On Heroes is one of his best. So, yeah. These are the kind of things that like we have to take it back. And that was the idea of putting together the publishing company in the first place.
Now, there have been recent examples in the United States of different school districts and university systems removing the classics from their curriculum, and this being celebrated as a victory for decolonialization, as they sometimes refer to it. What are your thoughts on the idea of a colonial curriculum and what the, you know, effort in opposition to that means for us?
So I actually wrote a series of articles on this one guy's website called Colonize Your Bookshelf, kind of in response to that. And what the series is taking particular texts and sort of reclaiming them from our standpoint, like trying to understand them. So these would be, well, they were the first one was Robert Filmer. The second one was Joseph de Maistre. The third one was, what's his name? Lothrop Stoddard's Into the Darkness, which is his book on Nazi Germany. And the fourth one was The Ancient City, which is a book that we put out. And yeah, I mean, obviously, like, the reason why they're trying to decolonize these themselves and decolonize their libraries is because, like, no matter what kind of, like, gay framing you put on something like Robert Filmer, the, like, from their perspective, the radioactive element just never decays. Like, you can never kind of get away from it. And from them, it's like, yeah, they just, it's completely corrosive to liberalism. Like, there's certain texts that no matter what you do, they will just corrode liberalism, like, this ultimate solvent. So they have to basically just get rid of that. They actually have to put a barrier between themselves and some of these ideas, because I mean, ultimately what liberalism is it's a series of cognitive dissonances and just like blatant contradictions. So the worst thing that you can do for a liberal is to just kind of shine a light on some of these things. And that's exactly what these texts do. So they actually have to just put some distance between themselves and like a Thomas Carlyle or a Joseph de Maistre or something like that. Like even stuff like Locke for them is kind of problematic.
Oh yeah, totally.
Just hilarious. Or Kant, like Kant was a complete racist, you know?
Yeah.
But yet
his anthropology. Like,
oh yeah. And Hume is like for these people, it's just like, you know, yeah, mouth open, just ridiculous. Like they just can't brook that, like for even well, 1 second.
It's like
this is a Hume hating podcast, and we've ripped into,
you know,
that.
I'm starting to appreciate
that,
you. I'm
sorry. That man multiple times over the years.
Yeah, I totally get that.
Nikkei just doesn't like him because he's fat.
Well, I think I've had a heuristic to the Western philosophy, and that it's if you're ugly, well, you're probably going to have some materialistic anti transcendental perspective that's, you know, I personally believe is wrong, and I think it's because you're ugly that you believe that. If you actually looked good, you probably wouldn't think the way you do.
That's so just who's the most like physically Chad philosopher, would you say? Who's got the highest bench?
That is a good question. I can't say I have an answer off the top of my head.
Maybe they're
mostly
all ugly.
Analyzed it from the reverse, like who's ugly, not who's strong. You know, it's sort of like a normal versus inferior. You know, I haven't really thought of it in terms of who exemplifies a superior, you know, physique. But that's a great question. I will look into that.
You know, it's funny. There are like paintings of Kant where he looks like a nice German, like, oh, he looks like a German, like healthy German guy. But there's other ones, like when he's older, or maybe they're more accurate, he looks like this frail, ugly little man.
He's like Gollum or something.
Yeah,
there's like
exactly.
A few paintings. And you wonder if they're just a shitty painter or if it's just a, you know, that's Kant.
Yeah, it's like we should bring him back for a meme or something, because that those
like,
paintings
no,
are
this
so
is like,
bad.
Yeah, it's like this painting is actually like, you know, picture perfect representation of his like troll physiognomy. But as far as like Chad philosophers, I'm going with Heraclitus, you know, and I think it's good. It's easy for me to say that because, you know,
choice.
He's not just purely on the basis of his philosophy, but, you know. Because, you know, nobody painted him in his time, so it's easy to say, I guess. Can't be wrong.
It is, which is why I you know, if I were willing to just do that, if I guess I were more Chad in my disposition towards this idea I have, I would have just said, you know, Plato, but because we don't really know what he looks like, I'm hesitant to make such a move at risk of, you know, delegitimizing my heuristic. Not that I should really care what other people think about it, but, you know, it has gotten me in some hot water with the fans of Schopenhauer. I do count him as an ugly nigga.
Yeah, I think that's probably accurate. And, of course, Plato, you know, the etymology of his name or nickname means broad-chested or broad-shouldered or something like that. So
I mean, you get that from your bench, man.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah, I actually didn't think, I mean, I guess Schopenhauer does look kind of skeleton-like, but I didn't think of him as particularly ugly, but maybe I have something wrong with me.
He does look weird, though.
Like, yeah, you know. He does. Maybe all of them do. I mean, Kierkegaard looks normal, but that's just like that sketch I've
seen. Well, he does, and like, you know, the only person who I've seen who hasn't like fallen into my normal heuristic who serves as a counterexample is Diderot.
I have no idea what he looks like.
Yeah,
actually.
I have no idea.
He looks his paintings are show him as very boyish, very young, very smooth. He just looks like a boyish Frenchman.
You know, I think Carlyle like had this manly like aspect. Reminds me of like my great grandfather or something. You know, this there's something healthy about him. It seems, but
yeah, I love those old pictures of like people from the 19th century where like nobody's smiling. I love that. Like, I think we should bring that back, to be honest, because like I always felt like an asshole. Like when people are like, you know, you smile. Take a picture with your family and they're like, yeah, say cheese. It's like piss off, you know.
Yeah.
I just like, I don't know. It always felt forced and everything. So to bring that back would just kind of suit me very well, actually.
Bring back not smiling.
Yeah.
Too much of that.
Yeah. Especially certain people, like they have a certain smile that you can tell is totally, I mean, it's obviously contrived. It has to be because you're being told to smile, but some are just so exaggerated that it's just like, okay, let's hold this back. Like interestingly related to that, like we found this chest of old family photos from like mostly from the late 1800s, early 1900s of my family from Sweden. And that is a thing where people just weren't, you know, trying to do like the selfie smiley little thing. But you want to know something sad about that chest? We've had that chest for a while. We kind of rediscovered it. It was up in our attic. My dad actually salvaged that chest. It was about to be thrown out by my grandpa and his brother because they're like, oh, this doesn't matter. This does not matter. You know?
Holy fuck, dude. That's priceless.
No, they knew that it was, and they knew what was in it, and they knew it was pictures of them too, because it's not just, it's mostly from like early 1900s, but it's also them in like the 50s when they were teenagers getting their cars and stuff. But it's like, it kind of personifies, like they personify this like very bad American or just decaying mindset where they would just think it's okay to just throw away all these pictures because you don't need them. You know, I already saw one when I was a kid, you know. I don't know how they...
Jeez.
Yeah,
that... I mean, if we want to read into that, it sort of seems like a
boomer
thing. Desire to, you know, lose the past.
Yeah, I don't know.
I sort of fall into the perspective that I like to hoard papers and pictures. I don't like throwing things like that away. You know, I have to really convince myself that this, you know, piece of paper isn't worth holding on to, or like, you know, I need to delete all of these photos. You know, not that I have any like hard photos I'd throw away, but you know, even with digital files, I feel weird deleting it.
Yeah. Well, it's like the back of my mind knowing that if I delete this file or if I get rid of this photo, there's literally no way I can get it again.
Yeah. Those pictures
30 years later, if I do need it, then
those pictures of our relatives coming from Sweden to America, like that would be lost forever if you just threw it in the dumpster because like, oh, we don't have room for it in our house.
Yeah, I can't relate to that mindset.
I don't know what was wrong with them because I just, yeah, they weren't too old at that time yet. They're like in their 50s. So, but even still, I think they would probably still do that. It's just like this kind of boomer, like, I don't care mindset maybe, or they're just psychos.
Yeah, I think that like reading into it, like we were doing is the right way to do it. You know, the right way to interpret it, like as sort of saying something about the broader culture of liberalism, where liberalism itself is basically, you know, it's a radical break from the past. It's sort of like a self-inflicted amnesia, really. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's what, one of the worst things that you can have, because, you know, one of the more interesting sort of writers that's come out of, you know, speaking of philosophers before, he's not the most Chad looking guy in the world, but, Alasdair MacIntyre, wrote a book called After Virtue. And basically it's sort of like the broad thesis of After Virtue is that, in order to, have any sort of like, you know, logic at all or any reason, what you need to do is you need to have assumptions. Obviously everybody knows this, but where do those assumptions come from? Well, they're inherited. They are non-rational. They come from the tradition ultimately. And you can either, you know, conduct reason in a way that's, you know, conscious and everything, by framing it according to the tradition. Or you can do it unconsciously, which is to kind of just, you know, pretend like it's all come from, you know, you've just sort of derived everything out of nothing, and then just not see where your categories have come from, which is like the worst thing that you can do. And that's, you know, one of the things that a guy by the name of J.G. Hamann leveled against Kant. He's a really, really interesting guy. Is that what Kant's trying to do is he's trying to just kind of pull himself up by his epistemic bootstraps and just start everything.
There's that word.
Yeah. And
I have to warn you, you can only say that word two more times or else your opinion gets discarded.
I'll just get disconnected from the chat, hey?
Yeah.
That's when the podcast is
like, sapere aude, whatever he says in the what is enlightenment that we went over on EBL.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Dare to know.
I have to go back and listen to that stream.
I don't know if it's up there because I think it might not be up there because I might have ruined it because I had to leave suddenly for some stupid reason and I just dropped out and it seemed kind of weird. I don't know. I couldn't find it. Maybe I'm just bad at finding things. Go on.
Yeah. I do remember that, like, I was really chomping at the bit to like dig into Kant there, and I didn't even get to talk about Hamann. I talked a little bit about Maestra. Anyway, Hamann, what he's doing, he was actually a friend of Kant, and they were like, they had quite a long correspondence. And he wrote this book called The Metacritique on the Purism of Reason. And basically, what he's saying to Kant is that, you know, you're trying to derive, you know, an entire set of like logical categories out of, you know, nothing, basically, or, you know, in what as Kant would frame it, out of completely a priori categories. But what he's doing is he's just sort of not seeing where his categories are actually coming from, which is ultimately he's pulling them from mostly like an inheritance from the ancient Greeks, you know, a priori versus a posteriori. These are categories that come directly out of Aristotle. So,
And a lot of the categories. Like, yeah, exactly. Aristotle. Yeah. Go.
It's not like they're sort of written across the face of the universe. This is something that's conventional, that's received, that's partial, you know, that, you either sort of understand that consciously or you just kind of get carried away and start believing that you've come up with things that like you haven't, basically. And this is what understanding the past does for you. You can kind of frame yourself according to the tradition, which is from which you've received everything, or you can just kind of be a retard. And, you know, for us to forget about the past and just say, you know, the past doesn't matter, we're just going to break radically with it. You can never break radically with the past. You can only just, like, you know, basically forget where you've come from. Mm-hmm. And that's, like, the worst thing. And ultimately, that's kind of, like, what liberalism is trying to do.
Yeah, and that's just, like, kind of what my grandpa and his brother did, just forget
the past. Well, it's, I mean, you know, not to hack on your family. I mean, it's the same with my family, right? Like, you know, I've got boomer parents and they're just like the same, you know, wonderful. I mean, I had wonderful parents, but they,
I love my grandpa. Like, but it's just, that was something weird that I can never forget. I was a kid then when I heard about that. My dad was like shocked too. My dad was like, I can't, he was almost like shaking when he figured out, when he heard that his dad was going to throw these pictures away, you know, he just couldn't understand.
It's terrifying to think that like the, these things are so fragile, and you learn about like ancient libraries and stuff like that, just sort of to broaden it out a bit, that in the past that just contained all of these like old books and everything that just get burned to the ground, and that like certain things sort of survive contingently from the past and other things don't. And you realize just how fragile the tradition can be, and the fact that it really does need to be kept up. Like, you know, here in Australia, where I'm living, the Australian Aborigines have a tradition that goes back probably to the last ice age. Like, you can tell, like, some of the vestiges of a tradition that old survive in their mythology. But it's all oral, right? So a huge amount of it has just been lost, which is really sad. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, we have every right to be chauvinistic about our European past because, you know, Europeans are quite a uniquely remarkable people, but there's value to be gleaned from quite a few other cultures. And it's, to me, it's quite sad that this stuff has been lost because, you know, much as they haven't like never, you know, raised any Hagia Sophias or anything like that, it's an ancient culture. It's been around for that long. It's something that, that has some value, I think. So, yeah, it's always sad to see that when a sort of oral culture or just even one's own family history kind of like reaches a point where you can go no farther.
What do you think of the sort of idea of a contemporary, like a corrective, or I guess some would describe it as reactionary destruction of, you know, new knowledge? You know, historically, this has been like a book burning or library demolishing ordeal. But I mean, today you see different sorts of efforts like just being deleted off the internet entirely. I mean, could that ever be justified, or do you believe that, you know, as a, you know, universal principle, this is always wrong?
Well, I mean, it could certainly work, which isn't the question you asked, but, you know, a lot of times, you know, you talk to progressives and they'll say something like that, you know, ideas can't be stopped, or that these things are inevitable. The march of progress is inevitable. It certainly can be stopped. And in the past, you can see examples of that. Of course, right now you can see attempts at erasing some of what's transpired in the last 4 to 8 years. You know, the internet right now is a lot less open than it was back in 2005 or something like that. Like, you know, there's more on it, and, you know, there's a few, like, particularly like the Internet Archive has done a lot of work trying to rescue old texts to the chagrin of the universities, but, you definitely can stop the spread of ideas. As for like whether you should or not, I mean, I'm not a free speech guy, and I'm not an anti-censorship guy. I don't want us to be censored, but I do absolutely understand the idea that there are some, places that you shouldn't go. You know, I mean, you can see this in Nietzsche, you can also see it in Joseph de Maistre. And so it's not a, you know, Christian versus atheist thing or anything like that. The idea of blasphemy is an idea that never goes away. I mean, right now we can see a sort of modern iteration of the concept of blasphemy. This is, like political incorrectness, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. Like on a structural level, there should absolutely be some things you're not allowed to say and think and do. And it's certain sort of like directions that you should not be allowed to go. Now, as for what those directions are right now, most of them are quite healthy. So the censorship that's going on right now is censoring the wrong things, but there's nothing wrong with that. Yeah, I don't really have a problem with that. And as much as we need to sort of pass on the tradition and revive the tradition and everything like that, I think that there's a certain degree to which interpreting the sort of core, like the traditional core imperatives at the heart of a civilization, trying to analyze and like logic chop those is actually a horrible thing to do. It's one of the quickest ways that you can sort of undo a society. And this is one of the things that like is a sort of recurring theme in Joseph de Maistre, is that society has to be founded on a sort of foundation that's so dark and unapproachable and foreboding that you would never dare approach it. Because when you do, when you start to apply reason to things like, you know, I don't know, take for example, like biblical analysis or whatever, this can be very, very corrosive to the tradition. And you can kind of see that. Like, there was, you know, going back, circling back to talking about Reddit, there was this subreddit on the site called r/academicbiblical or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was completely populated by atheists, pretty much. They had like a token sort of like Christian on there or whatever. But it was mostly people who wanted to undo the tradition and to sort of like pull it apart and then not put it back together. So
it's like those seminaries at big universities like that are filled with atheists. Like, I think
some. Yeah. Yeah. Like, I think the theology departments in universities are one of the best places you can go. You could probably find some of the most based people there, but ultimately, you know, applying, a very, very close scrutiny to these things can actually be quite bad. And this is kind of the ultimate, or one of the main sort of takeaways from that book I talked about at the beginning called New Science by Vico, is that reason comes in and like sort of acts as this universal solvent that just dissolves all the bonds of a society. Like, you can tell when they're about to die, when reason becomes sort of their main imperative. Because they will apply reason to the things that are sort of holding them together, which is not to say that we should all be like, you know, totally irrational and like making decisions on the basis of nothing at all, but that there's something prior to reason, and that reason has boundaries. So yeah, to sort of come back to your question, Nika, I think that there's absolutely reason to close off certain alleys of inquiry. Definitely.
Yeah, like, I know Noel just wishes e-girls have never existed, that they should be purged from the internet.
Yeah, there are certain topics that I think society would be a lot better if they just didn't exist.
Yeah, so censorship would be good in certain circumstances. But again,
yeah, censorship is good, but only when I do it.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with saying that.
I mean, effectively, that can be a principle, yes, because, you know, you can hold as a belief, you know, be consistent that those posts, you don't have the correct perspective and, you know, they are being a detriment to society at large. I think the problem with that is that there is a cultural norm in the West against that. You know, confounds that is, this norm doesn't seem to be applied when it's, you know, when censorship is shown towards, you know, people like us. You do have that to some extent from the, you know, what you'd call alt-light or, you know, libertarians, who are absolutists on free speech. But for the larger set of, you know, subgroup of society, on the progressive liberal wing, you don't see anything close to that. You know, you have that situation where they essentially hold the same position. Well, it's only right when we do it.
Yeah. And, well, you just said like I support free speech, but that's not speech. That's hate speech. We need to get rid of that. And the definition of hate speech just changes depending on.
Yeah. I don't think anyone practically believes in free speech. I think everyone has a sort of, there's something, maybe it's your, you know, cultural core that you just don't, you shouldn't talk about, you know, or just even your stupid ideology, even if it's materialist Marxism, or if it's some transgender ideology. There's certain things that if people criticize, you're like, hey, that's, you know, don't apply reason there. That's your free speech does not apply there. So I don't think anyone really practically believes in free speech. I don't know.
Free speech is mostly an Enlightenment idea too.
Yeah.
Like, if you look at some of these counter Enlightenment figures that came around in the like early 19th century, a lot of them are just very, very, you know, much against free speech. So, I take those guys at their word. They're pretty smart people. And, you know, just sort of to reiterate, I guess, there's reason why we have the idea of blasphemy, like that certain words and certain are not allowed to be spoken, certain ideas not allowed to be thought, this has been with us for a long time and exists in every culture. So pretty much anything that's stood the test of time, I think, has something going for it. And blasphemy is one of those. You know, it's the whole Lindy principle, right? Or the Lindy rule, that anything that's been around, or you can judge how long something is likely to be around by how long it has already been around. And blasphemy is a pretty old idea. So yeah, it's got to be serving some adaptive purpose, I would say.
I see. I think about this a lot because, you know, to my mind, there, I think most, Americans in specific, you know, who would agree with our perspective for the most part would, sort of have a disagreement when it comes to free speech, just because it's such a deeply ingrained, value, even, you know, on among conservatives and, you know, right leaning, to, you know, definitely far right,
but the same
groups in the States.
At the same time, though, the discussions like this are kind of, are not, it's not for everyone, right? So they're not going to be listening to this anyways. So,
yeah.
I suppose if you want to be, you know,
because it's like, you know, sort of by default, supporting free speech is supporting specifically our speech.
Yeah, exactly. Like you could be cynical and irrational, or I don't know if you consider that cynical, but you could just say, oh, I support free speech. But what you mean by that is actually what we're saying. You know, and I think you could do that, but I think
that is, you know, it's Machiavellian, but you know, there could be a case that Machiavellianism is good. It's, you know, what's needed on this question. I don't claim to know the answer to that, but I think it's worth considering.
You know, the answer can be figured out through pseudocode, like the analytic philosophers. Because it was funny because we. There's this tweet I saw, Mike, of some guy disproving God through...
Like some Turk trying to disprove the possibility of a Trinitarian God.
But he did it through, like, symbolic logic. I just thought it was funny. I don't know why. Not that I, like, entirely...
No, it wasn't even, like, symbolic logic. It was, like, literally pseudocode.
Oh.
Like, he was trying to use just, like, some programming language, you know, to disprove it. And I'm like, people really think that this is... Well, I mean... people implying Turks, but Turks really out here thinking that holds water.
Quote people, end quote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Divide by zero. God equals divide by zero. I don't know. That's somehow it's just not like, you know, rhetorically, it doesn't have that rhetorical punch that, you know, that you're looking for, I guess, but. It's pretty, I don't know, the idea of, like, disproving God through logic is just, like, pretty spurgy and retarded because, you know, the whole idea of, you know, if we're talking about a sort of monotheistic, you know, all-powerful, all-knowing creator of the universe, it's like, well, isn't that the sort of, again, we're coming back to the idea of, like, the limits of logic or, like, you know, the metacritic of the purism of reason is, like, where did the logical categories come from in the first place?
Yeah.
Well, they're given to us by, you know, something prior. Logic doesn't just sort of spring out of a void, and it comes from, I mean, we were talking about the tradition before, but you could say from a theological perspective, it issues forth from God himself. So to apply the idea of logic to God as though logic kind of stands over and above God is to kind of just not understand what God is in the first place.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really...
I feel like it's you could just very simply say, like, based on what we know of the concept of a God, then logic doesn't necessarily need to apply to something that's supernatural based on, you know, our assumptions of what's true for a supernatural being. I think it was just some Turk Roach being sued on the Twitters, but
I gave up my hateful ideology after someone on Reddit just did
the most after I read pseudocode on Twitter. Yeah,
someone on Reddit did the most perfect argument. Premises followed, you know, the conclusions rather followed from the premises, and I'm like, okay, now I believe. Now I'm sorry for my hateful ideology and the things I believe. I'll give up.
All I needed to do was learn assembler code, and then it could have all been avoided.
Disproved God using x86.
Yeah.
Don't know what that is, but sounds computer. I'm so bad at that stuff. Anyways.
So I actually used to be a computer programmer, and I'm so glad I got away from it. Holy crap.
I've heard nothing but horror stories from actual developers, because it's always the good ones that have to do all of the work, and then the like Indian code monkeys just get hired to do the rest.
How much can I make as an Indian code monkey? Can I still get like bank just being like mediocre?
A Greek code monkey.
Yeah, I mean, I probably could do good code, but if I don't have to, and I can still get paid.
I mean, bank to an Indian working in like, I don't know, the third world is $1 a day.
Yeah, fuck that.
Yeah, so speaking of going back to the press, Imperium Press, you have some future releases that are very exciting. Do you want to go over some of them before I point out the ones that really interest me?
For sure. Sorry, I thought I was muted there.
No worries.
But yeah, there's quite a lot. Basically, for the last year and a half or whatever, however long we've been doing this since September 2019, there's only been about 6, maybe 7 releases, if you count one translation of something, that have come out. We're aiming for this year to like triple that. So it's really super ambitious. We've already just put out a book by Josh Neal, who is kind of associated with, with EBL. He was on the EBL channel and sort of a little bit more distantly with Radix. His book just came out and it's doing very well so far. It's getting a lot of attention. Morgoth wrote a review on it. Kurt Doolittle actually wrote a review on it, a very detailed and good review on it, and quite a few other reviews are coming from other sort of people who are well known to in our circles, which is great. But we've got a few others as well. We have a series that started with a Jonathan Bowden interview last year called Studies in Reaction. And what this is it's supposed to be just kind of like short and punchy, like a few 100 to 200 page books that set out something like, you know, reactionary ideas in a very broad sense of reaction. This might even encompass something like fascism. I guess what the left would call reaction. And there's quite a few of those that are coming out this year. The first one is going to come out hopefully by the end of the month, but February. And that is a couple of essays by Thomas Carlyle. One of them being The Present Time, which gives the title to the book. And that one is actually the leading essay from his Latter Day Pamphlets book, which is, it's a great, like Latter Day Pamphlets is amazing. And The Present Time is like one of the best things he ever wrote, because it's just a very succinct, very, very, rhetorically amazing, deconstruction of the idea of democracy and of, you know, sort of liberalism more generally. So that'll be one of the essays that's in this book. There's another one that's going to be in there as well. And importantly for Carlyle, there's going to be a little glossary at the back of it as well that kind of like sets out some of these weird like coinages and Carlyleisms.
Thank goodness.
Because that stuff is really hard to parse. Like when I first read Carlyle, I think On Heroes is a little better, but when I first read the Latter Day Pamphlets, I only got like half of it, because there's so many things where he's talking about stuff that's like, you know, was only kind of even minor news in his time, because he's very much like, it's a social critic of Victorian England. A lot of that stuff we don't even know about anymore. So it's a lot of it is very hard to kind of understand. And of course he has all his own sort of like coinages, and he even like invents characters to stand for certain like stupid ideas, things he's trying to critique. So a lot of that can get kind of lost. Like you read it, you get a little bit lost. So we'll have a glossary in the back of that sort of helps keep you on track. There's going to be quite a few other things coming out in that studies and reaction series. We've got a big book of three major works by Joseph de Maistre. They're going to come out in a single volume. We're going to put one of those out as well as just a single study and reaction. That's the generative principle of political constitutions. There's going to be Filmer's Patriarcha is going to come out. Lots of stuff in that series. And we've got a few other Western canon books. So we started that series off with the Iliad. We're going to put out Beowulf. We're going to put out the Poetic Edda. And hopefully later on in the year, we'll also have something by Thomas 777. Do you guys know who he is?
Vaguely.
It sounds familiar.
He's one of the guys
that I've seen some of his Twitter rants before.
Yeah. So he comes out of the Salo Forum, which is like that guy who used to be fisted by Foucault. And he's an excellent, excellent commentator. Is like very well read and sort of an encyclopedic, has an encyclopedic knowledge of all things like fascist and third position. So he's going to write, he's got a book that's, he's in the process of writing right now. It's going to be on the Nuremberg trials and sort of the idea that Nuremberg was a death blow to the idea of the nation state, and just sort of like pointing to this particular series of trials as where the sort of the birth of globalism. I mean, globalism has kind of been long in coming, but this is where globalism really kind of stepped into the spotlight, where the idea of human rights, which kind of has to stand over and above the rights granted by the nation state, where this idea sort of came to the fore. So that's going to be great. There is so much stuff coming out. Yeah, I could just talk, I could go on and on and on about it. But yeah, we're going to try and get out at least 20 books this year. So it's, we're going to really have to hustle. But, you know,
going for a race against the Antelope Hill, I see.
Yeah, no, they've got quite a lot coming out as well. I have seen a bit of their schedule. Those guys are amazing. We have regular contact. We work together on some things. And
oh yeah, I know the whole sphere is very amicable, and there's a lot of back and forth connection between the two, which I think is obviously very healthy and great for productivity and sharing like inspiration.
Yep. No, we're good friends with those guys. There's quite a few other publishing companies as well. Rogue Scholar is another great one.
Yeah, I think
Mystery Grove. All these guys are doing excellent work, and we're all sort of working in slightly different veins. Mm-hmm. We kind of like Imperium Press. We bill ourselves as like the classics department of the dissident right. So, I mean, we've put out new books too, and some stuff that's like, you know, not exactly classics, like stuff from the 20th century, but we're all kind of doing something a little bit different, which is great. I mean, there's, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom or whatever.
Right. When are we going to hear more from Taxarchia Press? I have, their translation of On the Resistance to Evil by Force. As far as I know, that's all they have published.
They've got a few books out. I think they've got about four or five, something like that. So one that I would really recommend that everyone read, this is one that we were going to do, but then we learned they were doing it, so we just kind of stepped back from it, is a book by Othmar Spahn called The True State. And what it is, he is a corporatist in like pre-war Germany. I think it's pre-war Germany. Pre-World War II, anyway. Might have been around World War I. And this book is basically him sort of setting out a theoretical basis for corporatism. And it's also folded into that is a very deep critique of Marxism. It's an excellent, excellent book. It's been very, very, it was very influential on the Third Reich. And it's one of the best sort of expositions of what you might call neo-feudalism. So great book. I can't recommend that highly enough. That's by Taxiarch Press. I think that's how you pronounce it. But they've got great books as well. Antelope Hill has lots of really interesting stuff. I was very interested in that Wehrmacht physical training manual.
I do have a copy of that. It's great.
That is so cool. That what a great idea to republish that. And that these are the kind of things that would have fallen through the cracks that nobody, you know, I mean, you never find that in the university library.
Yeah, you might find a PDF or a scanned copy, but that's not the same thing. That's I can't read PDFs. I hate that personally. It's like
you have to know how to open it.
I love the physical book. There's something just about having them. And for the longest time, I didn't even have a Kindle or didn't read anything on my phone or anything.
Yeah.
So it's important that these things come back.
It's tolerable if it's formatted for an ebook, because it could like fit your screen on your phone. That's fine. I could do that. But sometimes like reading a PDF is hard because it doesn't, you know, getting the footnotes and all that stuff and getting the endnotes. Yeah. It's like impossible sometimes.
When it's just like a direct scan of a book that you're reading on as a PDF, it can sometimes just feel weird.
Yeah.
It's like, feel like the text is way too small, so you're straining your eyes or the contrast is too high. And
things have come a long way.
For me reading.
I just remember reading like years ago when I did get my Kindle. Moldbug has this sort of like short Carlyle syllabus where he's like, read this and then this and this and this in this order. And I read the first one in that, which is Chartism, his book called Chartism. And I downloaded it from the Kindle store. There was like a free version of it. And they just copied and pasted it direct from this shitty like OCR scan of it. And it was like garbled, you know?
There was
a lot of stuff. I couldn't even read it, you know?
Yeah, like, stuff like that happens a lot when you see it.
I guess that's what happens when you get it for free. I mean, I could have gotten like a paid version or like a, you know, real ebook of Carlyle, but then I'd be reading those like five introductions that tells me that he's reactionary. So, you know, things have gotten a little bit better as far as that is concerned.
Yeah, totally. Like I've had that experience where I downloaded a book and it's just like a Word document, literally copied from something like that, some similar process. And it's like, okay. But you know what? I'm excited for this. You're doing a Latin course. You're reprinting a Latin course. Can you talk about this Latin course, which, you know?
Yep. No, definitely. That's going to be very, very interesting. So it's kind of undergone a little bit of an evolution. What's on the website right now is not fully up to date because it was originally like something that I personally was working on because Latin is something that, you know, I learned it years ago and I'm passionate about it. It's something I find very interesting. Everyone should learn a dead language of some kind, and that's a fine one to do. That's what, you know, every Victorian schoolboy would start with as far as a second language or whatever. So Latin is absolutely worth learning. And what we started out with was the idea, or as far as a text, was the Eton Latin Grammar, which is the original, it's what every Victorian English schoolboy would have learned. But we sort of, in sort of like looking at this, we've decided that might not be the best one to go with because there's actually quite a few really, really good Latin grammars from the 19th century. Mm. We've hit upon this one from Collar and Daniel are the people that put it together. And it is very, very good. And what we're going to do is basically use that as the skeleton. That'll be the like grammar translation side of it. And we're going to have quite a bit of reading material as well. And basically the idea is that you take the grammar, like this Latin grammar, and work your way up to being able to read Caesar's Gallic Wars unadapted. which is actually, if you look, if you take something like WeLock, which is the one that I, the Latin grammar that I used to learn, that doesn't get you that far. You actually, it, once you finish WeLock, which is a long process, you still can't read Caesar. And when I came out of it on the other end of it, I was just like, what the fuck? Like, you know, isn't this the idea? I mean, it gets you most of the way there. You still have a lot, a bit of a ways to go. There's a gap, and that's mostly filled in with reading material. So there's, for the audience that may not be familiar, there's basically two kind of like approaches to learning any language. There's the grammar translation method, which is where you do, you learn the grammar, you do exercises, and you, you try and translate from one, you know, from English to Latin or vice versa. And then the other approach is what's called the natural method, which is basically you learn by immersing yourself in reading material. So there's two main, like, Latin, well, I mean, now there's quite a few, but like the classic Latin grammar is WeLock's. And there's a book that was published, I don't know when, about 30 years ago, called Lingua Latina Per Se Illustrata. And that one is, what it is it's basically all Latin. There's not a word of English in this book. And you start out with really simple stuff, like stuff that we all can understand, like Italia est in Europa. So we can understand what that means. And it starts out from this really super basic sentence, or these basic sentences, and it builds itself up into where you're actually reading unadapted Latin, like from classical authors. It's actually quite a remarkable type of pedagogy. Oh, yeah, so totally. It's really great, but it also is a little bit incomplete. You really need both. You need all the reading material, the natural method, to be able to understand things contextually, and it really accelerates your vocabulary. But you also need the grammar. Otherwise, it's like, it just takes forever to learn some of this stuff and to see like these weird, what look like really weird grammatical constructions. You just, if you've gone through and actually, like, you know, done all the grammar stuff, you, that accelerates your learning in this other way. So you need both. And basically the idea of the Latin course is we're going to take a really well-known and very excellent 19th century Latin grammar. We're going to pair it with quite a bit of reading material, because there's lots and lots of Latin practice reading material out there. And we're going to build up, we're going to actually put together with like exercises and course notes and things like that. It's going to be a complete course of several books that basically get you up to where you can read Caesar. And there's, we're going to actually put out two books of Caesar's Gallic Wars, one of which is the whole first book of the Gallic Wars, where every word is parsed. And then the second book, where it's sort of like a reader that like has the full text and just gives you sort of like little bits and pieces of like grammatical information at, along the way. So it's a big project. It's not going to be done this year, but it's going to be out probably next year. And we've got a classical scholar that is helping us out with that. So it's going to be, it's the real deal. It's going to be like a serious Latin course.
That's awesome. Because, yeah, I've noticed from my experience teaching myself languages, I've had times where I'd say like the first foreign language I learned on my own kind of was German. And I started that like maybe 10 years ago. And I spent most of that time trying to learn through the natural method without studying much grammar. But I realized that actually you need both. And I'm glad that you're combining both methods, you know, the grammar translation method of the old school and the more modern, I guess you could say, a natural method, because you need both. You can't just, I feel like there's a tendency to just rely on one. But
yeah. So like with the natural method, you'll get so far as you can sort of understand it, but then, yeah, as you said, you'll reach some kind of like roadblock and have no idea what it means.
Yeah,
you can, it being like, if it's not explained that this is actually a grammatical rule or some exception to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah, it seems like you kind of go through these cycles where, again, sort of like a microcosm of the whole like liberalism as, you know, hating and wanting to erase the past is like the grammar translation method is seen as like old and obsolete and kind of like, you know, we don't do those sort of things anymore. And that's what we used to do and stuff. So,
yeah, so we have to just throw
now
it
it's all about, now it's all about the natural method, which is great. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the natural method. You need it, but you also need the other side of it as well. So, and I mean, I can't pretend like I've read every single Latin grammar out there. There's probably some that like do a pretty good like marriage of the two, but you know, we're going to do that with the Latin course. We're going to have a really good synthesis of the two methods, because you need both. Like when I was learning Wheelock's doesn't come with anywhere near enough reading material, so I had to like find stuff. And like, actually, there's a great website that has like supplemental exercises. It's not even like anything to do with Wheelock's, but it has like supplemental exercises for that text. And you know, I think that's important. I think everyone should try to learn Latin. I know it's a tall order, and it might seem like, you know, kind of like maybe there's better stuff that you can do with your time. But there's a reason why, like, all these people like from the 19th century, 18th century used to insist that people would have to learn this stuff, mm-hmm. right? Like, at the very least, what it does is it forces you to read the actual thoughts and the actual language of people like Julius Caesar, people like, you know, Cicero, or even better, Cato the Elder. Like, these people were extremely based. And in some ways, like, reading a translation doesn't quite capture everything. Like, the example I like to use is something like mos maiorum, which is it's a term that means tradition. Normally, you'll see this term translated in English translations as tradition. But the literal meaning of it is custom of the ancestors, and which is a little bit sort of like, I mean, that's what tradition is, of course. But there's a kind of connotation there where maiorum, of the ancestors, also means of the superiors, right? Mm. Like ancestors or elders and betters or superiors were synonyms for these people. So these are the categories in which a Roman would think. And so for a Roman, to question tradition is like to question your betters, which is basically like for the bug man, like, you know, in 2021, it's like trying to question science. They would never think to do that, right? And these are the categories that Romans had inherited just from their linguistic structures. So sort of to reiterate something that we talked about, language absolutely circumscribes and frames the way that you think. And so learning to think, learning to speak or read Latin is actually to learn to think the way that, like, you know, an archaic or a classical Roman would. And, you know, these people were extremely based. And part of that was because of the way that their language was structured. So it's important to learn this stuff, I think.
And you can flex on people at the bar by just speaking fluent Latin to order your drink.
Yeah.
It's really the most important reason to learn another language.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. You'd be surprised how many, quote-unquote, classical scholars don't know shit about Latin. Like,
I've heard.
You look at, like, a Donna Zuckerberg or something like that. Like, she does not know her Latin very well, and it shows. You know, this is the only way that she can continue to, like, dunk on these people and hate what she studies, is to not really know it very well. So, yeah.
Well, I know you have to go soon, Mike, and I think I have to get going too. So I think we should end it here. It was nice having you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It was wonderful.
I enjoyed this conversation a lot.
Yeah, and nice having Noel back as well. It's been a while.
Yeah, I've been resting for a while, sleeping in my cave.
But I think he'll be coming back. So don't worry about that, guys. But anyways, thank you guys for listening. You could check out, do you have any links you want to send? Twitters, websites?
Yep. So basically the main way that you can contact us is by going to imperiumpress.org. And our main sort of like outreach point from there is Twitter. So follow @ImperiumPress. And we're always, like, every day tweeting spicy takes on this and that, book stuff, illiberal stuff, reactionary and fascist stuff, all kinds of things. So
all it's extremely based.
Extremely based, yeah.
When was the last time you posted cringe? Can you even think of a time you ever did that?
I might have posted meta cringe by posting the idea that, like, cringe itself as a word should be retired. So I don't know. That might be cringe, but
I think time is yet to decide. Yeah, so
we got to see.
Possibly, but not yet. As of now, never posted cringe. You heard it here first.
Yeah. Yeah. Cringe is not Lindy, and we only post Lindy.
Yeah.
So. I love it. Dude, Paul Skylus is my boy.
Yeah.
Anyways, well, thank you guys for listening, and thank you, Mike.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Bye-bye.